Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to New Books in Medicine, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name's Claire Clark. I'm one of the hosts of the channel. And today I'm talking to Greg Wren about his fantastic new memoir, Mothership, a memoir of wonder and crisis, which is just out by Regalo Press. Greg is an associate professor, English professor at James Madison University, where he teaches environmental literature and creative writing, and weaves climate change science into literary studies. And we are thrilled to be able to welcome him to the show. So, Greg, welcome.
Good morning, Claire. It's such a delight to be here. Hi.
Hi. I wonder if you could begin our interview by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself. So introduce yourself.
Sure. Hi, everyone. My name is Greg Wren. And I am a professor. I'm an English professor. I'm a trained poet who has largely left poetry aside and turned my attention to prose writing, to memoir writing. And as you said, my book Mothership is coming out on March 26th. And I'm telling people it's a queer ayahuasca eco-memoir. And so it's probably the best way to get to know me is reading the book. But I'm a husband and I am an environmentalist and I guess you could say a psychonaut as well in terms of working with psychedelic medicines in safe legal settings. And I'm also a scuba diver. And I've spent a lot of my life exploring coral reefs across the globe. And those encounters with endangered coral reefs are an important part of Mothership.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about how you came to write Mothership? Because it's a memoir of your whole life. So in a sense, you've been writing the book your whole life. But what led you to try to put it all together right now at this point in your life?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think maybe the most glib answer would be midlife crisis. I am 44 years old. And I experienced significant childhood trauma until I was about 17 or 18 years old. And so there was a backlog of pain and, I suffer from complex PTSD. That's one of the things that as a focus of the book of Mothership is how I turned to coral reefs and psychedelic plants like ayahuasca to heal from complex trauma, to save my life and to heal PTSD. So that pain propelled me to write this book. But it not only sort of personal pain propelled me to write the book. It was also, I guess you could say, eco-anguish, eco-anxiety that that motivated me to write the book, that inspired the book. Because the book, yes, it's about healing from childhood trauma, but in healing childhood trauma, my ecological conscience, you could say, woke up. And so that that desire to sort of sound the alarm about the climate crisis is a big part of the book, but it's also trying to raise awareness, I guess you could say, about sort of alternative ways to heal a condition that's notoriously difficult to treat, right? Developmental trauma, relational trauma, complex trauma, CPTSD, no matter how you put it, it's this disorder of trust that arises when someone is subjected to interpersonal abuse by a caregiver and they're unable to escape. So all those things propelled me to write this book, and it was exhilarating at times, and then of course terrifying at others, and then also just very humdrum, living calm is around. So it was a good reflection of life itself. Just lots of ups and downs were involved in writing this book.
Well, you're an award-winning poet and you're an English professor and you read and write for a living. I teach in a college of medicine and I feel like I spend much of my days entreating people to reflect, doing reflective writing with healthcare professionals and advocating for the importance of doing that kind of writing. I wonder if you could talk. This whole book is reflective writing. That's what a memoir is. Can you talk a little bit about the value of reflective writing?
My gosh, it's a great question. It couldn't be a more timely question. I see in my students the effects of a lifetime of staring at screens, pecking at screens. I see students starting to write poems using ChatGPT and offering poetry feedback to one another in workshop using ChatGPT. So the stakes are very high. And reflection is what makes us human. We are meaning-making machines, it's been said. And so for me as a trauma survivor, for me to continue on, I had to make meaning. I had to reflect on what I endured. And to not reflect on it, to be numb, to be in the addictive spirals that I was in, is not sustainable for my individual life. And so I had to reflect on it. And these, I should say, ayahuasca, these psychedelic medicines, they enabled me to reflect. They enabled me to make connections that I wouldn't normally have been able to make. And that's what reflection is, right? It's synthesizing, right? Different ideas that previously were siloed. And we can even look at brain scans, and we can see that when someone is experiencing a psychedelic journey, previously compartmentalized parts of the brain start talking to one another, like as in a child, or as in just like a nun who's deep in prayer or meditation. And so so these medicines enabled me to reflect on really challenging things like the climate crisis, like the captivity that in many ways was my childhood, and to reflect too on where we're going. Where are we going in a society where people are not reflecting the way that they have? Which isn't to say that people have always been thoughtful, or a fat, or that needs, you know, sort of Tibetan monk-like attention spans. But they did, there was time to rest and digest. The sympathetic nervous system was not always activated. And so many of us are in the red zone. So many of us are in amygdala hijack. And it's not just trauma survivors. It's so many of us, because we're inundated with information and inundated with so many different crises. And so yes, reflective writing that is the technology that I want to promote. That is the technology that I want to promote, is that kind of reflective is reflective writing. And out of that reflection, you create. Out of reflection, your imagination awakens. And then maybe you can imagine a different way to do things. Maybe there is an upending of the status quo that can happen when enough people are reflecting. It's always been that way. And so we can't be on autopilot, because we will not survive. You know, I didn't survive personally. I couldn't have survived personally if I didn't begin to reflect on some of the terrible things from the past. And you know what? Humanity won't either. It won't survive if it doesn't begin to imagine another way and have its own kind of conscience, not reawaken, but come more to the forefront, because we have a conscience already, but it just needs to be brought more to the forefront, and we need to think, need to think along more ethical lines and value the imagination and value reflection. It's very important. Scientists and artists alike.
Well, I wholeheartedly, you're preaching the choir here. I couldn't agree more. I like to continue along on this theme of this book bringing together your teaching and your life. So Mothership opens with the opening lecture of your fall 2019 offering of environmental literature of wonder and crisis. And then your memoir contains readings from authors and texts, and these are as diverse as, you know, you've got Walt Whitman, Adrienne Rich, Rachel Carson, Alice Walker, E.T., even the A&E TV show Obsessed. So if you could recommend one companion reading, a kind of single text to read or view alongside Mothership, I think I know what it is, but I'm going to ask what would it be and why?
Okay. Well, I have two answers. The first is going to seem like a cop-out, and I won't go too much into it. I'll just sort of throw it out there. The first, I think, text is nature itself, like being outside, like stopping the gorging of information, the devouring of information. Like so many of us just need to unplug, myself included. Oh boy. Tried to promote a book. I tell you, writing a book, you begin to feel like a cyborg. So, So I think that really being in nature, that is the text. That is the movie. That is the Netflix series that I would recommend to people. And we'll go, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about that. But the more straightforward answer is I actually, you know, there are lots of things I would recommend. You know, I would recommend Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. I would recommend Walden by Henry David Thoreau. I would recommend Walt Whitman, of course. But I think that the one I'm going to choose is a novel, a dystopian novel by Octavia Butler called Parable of the Sower. And this novel takes place, if listeners, just in case you don't know what this novel is all about, it's written by a Black science fiction writer, very famous. She has passed away, but her name is Octavia Butler. And she imagines Southern California 30 years in the future. She's writing in the early 90s, around the same time that the Rodney King riots took place. So she definitely had a sense of foreboding about the future. And the alarm was beginning to be rung, was beginning to be truly sounded about climate change at that time. So she's imagining 30 years of the future, and she has a protagonist, a Black young woman named Lauren Olamina. And so it's a coming of age novel. She's living in Southern California, and climate change is worsening, and the societal conditions are quite scary. And to make a long story short, she has to leave her family. She has to leave her community. And she ends up founding a new religion, which doesn't exactly have a god. The god, she says, is change itself. Not Shiva, right? Shiva in the Hindu tradition could be considered a god of change or of transitions or of death. But this is more the abstract idea of impermanence. Well, the abstract idea and also just the lived experience of impermanence. And, you know, I love this book for so many reasons, and I recommend this book for so many reasons. First off, so much of the canon of environmental literature is written by straight white men. And so it's really refreshing to have a different take on the future and on on ecological conscience and consciousness. So, you know, why I love this book is that, you know, it's not The Road by Cormac McCarthy. It's not Going It Alone by any stretch of the imagination. Lauren Olamina, she depends on other people. She creates a community of people. She survives on her journey to safety. She survives by depending on other people, and other people depend on her. And so I love that vision. I don't love the vision of organized human life unraveling, but I love the vision of people depending on each other, because community, I tell you, community will be as important as any seawall, any solar farm, or any carbon sequestration technology in the future. As we race to stabilize the planet's climate, community will always be essential to our survival. And so I love this vision of community becoming all the more important in the face of crisis. And also too, you know, there is this, not to give too much away, but, you know, her vision is that she wants to leave the earth. She wants to, I guess, board a mothership of sorts and go to a different planet and found a new, like, start over there. She wants to start over. And, you know, we do need to start over. We do need a fresh start. And that fresh start, that can be forced upon us through a runaway greenhouse effect, or it can be something that we more consciously ease into or switch into. So, you know, it's also this hope, like, even under the most dire of circumstances, Lauren Olamina, this young female protagonist, so strong, so courageous, so full of grit, she imagines a new world. And that human adaptive optimism that mindset is what has sustained us as a species. And so it's a dystopian novel, but there is a lot of hope there. And there's a lot of action too. And there's a lot of nerding out to be had in the book too, because it's a science fiction novel. So I would recommend Parable of the Sower by Octavia Butler if I had to give one answer today.
Oh, I have heard so much about that novel and I haven't read it. So now I've got to check it out. And I was wrong. I thought for sure you'd say E.T. They're reading this book.
Maybe, yes, I know.
This book made me want to watch E.T. again.
Yes, E.T., one of my first ecological teachers. I guess I might say that on a different day. for sure, because ET was and is still so important. It's still, it's about hope, right? It's hope, and so, you know, and in that film, you know, it's interesting because, you know, science is scary largely in that movie, right? These NASA scientists showing up in spacesuits and trying to break down their door, and but then we see this very kind scientist towards the end who takes off his mask and relates to Elliot directly, you know, beautifully, and by, you know, beside what we think is E.T.'s tomb, but really it's his kind of resurrection chamber. And so it, you know, it has a mixed kind of take on science, but I firmly believe in science. Of, you know, it goes without saying, you know, in a book that has, you know, 70 peer-reviewed articles woven into it, you know, I believe in science. And so I think that, you know, I think this is why I so enjoy teaching the courses that I do, because I can infuse science into it. And even when I talk about parable of the sower, you know, I show them graphs of carbon concentrations increasing and the temperatures increasing and social inequality, you know, increasing, and you know, the income of a graph showing the changes in the average income, you know, in Black households in the United States. So there's just so much, it's so juicy and it's so fascinating to bring all of these disciplines together. Science is some science rocks.
Yeah, and I wanted, that was the next thing I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit more about, because for our listeners, this memoir has 20 pages of references in it, which I feel like is something you don't often see in memoirs, but there's a lot of research that went into it, and that is kind of woven into the narrative in a really elegant way. So since the audience of this podcast is mostly people interested in medicine and history of medicine, medical humanities, can you talk a little bit about the current science, what the current science says about both nature and psychedelic therapy as pathways to healing from complex PTSD?
Sure. I think I'll focus first on the science behind psychedelic therapy. And, you know, I should say, you mentioned medical humanities, Claire. I just learned fairly recently, you know, getting on the Google, I discovered this phrase, psychedelic humanities.
Oh my goodness.
I relish that phrase and love the nexus. The exciting nexus that it represents. But, you know, in terms of the science behind psychedelic therapy, I mean, you know, and this is what this book does, is it shows, you know, how does psychedelic therapy, psychedelic assisted therapy, how does that evidence-based psychedelic assisted therapy, how does a person live into that, right? What would cause someone to reach for that, and how does it fit into a life, and how does it change a life? So it's again, it's an interplay of the humanities or even anthropology and science. But in terms of the CPTSD and psychedelic therapy, you know, we had these these phase three trials of MDMA assisted therapy for PTSD that's coming out of MAPS, Rick Doblin and MAPS, that organization. You know, yes, that phase they're testing MDMA assisted therapy for folks who suffer from PTSD, right? Folks who have experienced a terrible car crash or have experienced a sexual assault, which is different than complex PTSD, right? So, but in any case, in this phase three trial of MDMA assisted therapy for PTSD, that clinical trial, some of those clinical trials included patients that were suffering from complex PTSD, and those folks did beautifully. They saw They saw, even though their trauma was it was interpersonal, and they couldn't escape it, and it was in childhood as opposed to a car crash in adulthood, it didn't matter. Folks who suffered from complex PTSD, they saw their symptoms reduced significantly. And so, you know, so part of what I'm doing as I go on podcasts and as I go on my book tour is I'm discussing my firsthand experiences with ayahuasca, this psychedelic rainforest tea, as a highly effective treatment for developmental trauma, which again is widely known by clinicians as difficult to treat. And I'll be speaking to the Yale psychedelic science group about this. I'm speaking to a variety of folks about this. So, you know, ingesting ayahuasca, to kind of boil it down, it increases neuroplasticity, right? It makes the brain more malleable, more coachable. It also fosters neurogenesis, the birthing of new neurons in the hippocampus and other places. It causes epigenetic modulation. So certain genes, you could say, are turned off, and certain genes are turned on, often to the benefit of the patient. And then most excitingly, and then of course it's a rapid antidepressant, unlike Zoloft, which can take 6 to 8 weeks to work, if it ever works. You know, ayahuasca is a rapid antidepressant that can begin working within 24 hours of ingesting it. But, and it works against outs of anxiety, so many things. But the thing that I am so fascinated by and that I can't stop talking about is that psychedelics like ayahuasca, they reopen the critical periods for social reward learning. And this is what's so exciting for me as someone who, you know, who's a CPTSD, who suffered from CPTSD, is that, you know, it is a disorder of trust. What causes the panic to arise in someone with CPTSD is bonding. And so what better way to treat CPTSD than to reopen those critical periods for social reward learning, to be in a setting that is safe and loving, where you're getting the right inputs as those critical periods for social reward learning are reopened. And not only do you, and this is from my experience, and I talk about this at length in my book, Mothership, not only are you learning to bond and relate to other people, but you're learning how to skillfully bond and relate with yourself. And if you can relate to yourself more kindly, more skillfully, you are going to stop doing the stupid shit that you were doing. And so this is why I call, this is what I call the reparenting force of ayahuasca. The reparenting force of ayahuasca, because we've all got that internalized set of parents in our brains. We all do. And those of us who experience developmental trauma have some really messed up models for parents in our heads. And so what psychedelics do is they change that internalized parent. And in the case of ayahuasca, there is this perceived entity, I know, entity, here we go, of Madre Ayahuasca, which, you know, research out of Johns Hopkins and other places has shown, right, this is a hallmark of the DMT experience, of ingesting DMT, and ayahuasca has a lot of DMT in it, is that you experience an entity. And so in the case of Madre Ayahuasca, she is teaching you. She is reparenting you. And the neurological parallel for that, I think, is this critical period, these critical periods for social reward learning are reopening. And Gul Dolan, one of my heroes, I've never met her. She is, I'm a total fangirl of hers. She gave MDMA to octopuses, which are notoriously territorial and solitary. And those octopuses were cuddling after they were given MDMA. And so Gul Dolan is the one who really discovered that these critical periods for social reward learning reopened with psychedelics. So, and then to answer the second part of your question more succinctly, you know, one of the inputs that's important to have when it, you know, after a psychedelic experience or even before a psychedelic experience to prepare, but especially after a psychedelic experience, is being in nature. Because nature isn't, that nature doesn't judge you. Nature is, if you're in the right place, is beautiful. It teaches you everything you need to know about how all things change. Birth, death is not the end. Birth, death leads to birth. This is part of being in nature. It shows you that, yeah, that death is a part of life. Suffering is a part of life. Just being in nature and being attuned in nature is, and so that is a really great input, you could say, to have in the wake of a breakthrough psychedelic experience, because nature, I've been in the Amazon working with these medicines, and you begin to feel that the rainforest itself is your mother and your new mother. And so nature, you feel that reparenting force, and whether that's actually happening or not is beside the point. The point is that this is helping people. This is helping veterans save their lives. It's helping people with CPTSD live meaningful lives in society. And so the research is, you know, I go so much more into the research around nature therapy and psychedelic therapy in my book. But this is kind of, you know, what I just gave you is sort of just really the tip of the iceberg. I hope it's rich and provocative enough for your listeners.
No, that's wonderful. And nature, you know, you've fully disclosed to our listeners that Greg and I grew up in the same time and place, Jacksonville, Florida, in the 1980s and 90s, and even went to the same high school. But I felt you know, the Florida coast, North Florida coast, so beautifully and accurately rendered in this book. And now, you know, like you being a professor in a particularly pastoral part of Appalachia, thought that that was, you also really did a wonderful job of capturing that kind of setting. And made me want to go scuba diving too, which I've never been. I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about the role nature played in your own coming of age process as well as healing process, because this is a kind of, I mean, you said it was inspired by a midlife crisis, but the memoir is also, it's a little bit of a coming of age story in a way. Yeah.
Yes, it was. And I think I instinctively, you know, growing up, under the circumstances that I did, I knew that being outside away from people, I knew I felt better. Before I even knew the word, you know, the phrase amygdala hijack even a phrase like rest and digest, you know, before I knew any of those things or before I'd ever heard of those things, I knew that I didn't feel the panic that I did elsewhere when I was in nature. And so whether that was in my backyard or it was, yes, on the coastline of Florida, on certain barrier islands, away from people, away from high rises, I felt better. And I used to call it sort of gathering my being. And so, yes, we know that going into nature activates the parasympathetic nervous system. And so, we know that forest bathing is something that since the 1980s has been prescribed, prescribed by Japanese doctors to their patients, to their stressed out patients. And so there's so much research out there about the healing, the mental health benefits of being in nature. And Florence Williams' book, The Nature Fix, I'll definitely recommend that to folks. It's an incredible overview of all that research. But also I would say I also felt I talked about being on the coastlines and being in my backyard and the forest of my backyard, but another place, maybe the place that I felt the most safe and the place that I, that was, I guess you could say, in my church, was underwater. My family and I went to the Florida Keys growing up, and, you know, those reefs even then in the late 80s, early 90s were diseased and dying. But to see them still beautiful in a way, but also suffering, awakened a lot of compassion in me. Compassion that I maybe forgot when I got into the throes of addiction and lived my adult life. But I mean, it left my conscious mind, but it never left my soul. It never left the recesses of my hippocampus. So being underwater, snorkeling and diving, provided so much healing for me as a kid. And I wouldn't have even known to say that. I would have just said, I like it because you don't talk when you're underwater. Nobody talks. And the beauty of coral reefs, it's an alien world. You know, it's almost like I had boarded a mothership when I got on a dive boat and then I suited up and entered this alien realm. And so, because I felt like an alien, so it felt on point to be an alien in an alien realm. And again, no talking and no one talking and you don't, there's no real evidence of humanity. And the coral couldn't touch me. The coral couldn't abuse me. The coral couldn't say things to upset me. The coral just let me be, let me float. And the water helped me forget my traumatized body. And so this is what mothership is about. It's about slowly but surely learning to reclaim not only my body, but my imagination, my mind's eye. And that, you know, consciousness is a workspace, and experience dependent neuroplasticity is my greatest hope. And so I continue to be hopeful about humanity, because there is the possibility, just like Octavia Butler envisions, there is the possibility of a fresh start. There is a way to, in terms of the psychedelics, you know, another thing I didn't mention is fear extinction. And you neurologists out there know this, you know, that psychedelics like ayahuasca, they reprogram the fear response. And in my case, the fear response involved in bonding, and they foster self-compassion. And if humanity can reprogram its fear response and foster self-compassion, then we're on a good road. We're on a good road, but that isn't the road that we're on right now. And psychedelics are not the only answer to that, of course. I'm no psychedelics evangelist. These medicines can be abused. These medicines can be in the wrong hands, but they do offer hope under the right circumstances. And so and they come from nature. You know, to circle back to your question, they, at least the ones that I use, they come from nature. And so, you know, when I am drinking ayahuasca, when I am ingesting ayahuasca, I'm ingesting the rainforest and its microbiome into my body, into my gut, and some of it's going through the blood-brain barrier, and voila. it's exciting, but it doesn't mean that we're headed for some utopian future, because we know that utopia literally means no place, so it's not really going to happen. But we don't have to destroy ourselves.
Well, that leads into my next to last question, which is about mothership as a kind of call for action. The last person that I talked to for the New Books Network was this scholar, philosopher named Travis Reeder. And he has got this book out called Catastrophe Ethics. And that book is all about how to make individual decisions in the face of overwhelming and seemingly insurmountable problems like climate change and intergenerational trauma, which is sort of the meat of this book you're writing about.
Yes.
What actions do you hope that your book might inspire readers to take?
Well, I hope that it inspires, first off, I hope it inspires my depressed readers, my readers who feel that they're doomed and that everything is doomed. I hope that it inspires in them hope, and it's hope that is in the science, in a way. You know, it's the hope is embedded in the science that, you know, if we can sequester carbon, you know, if we can reduce carbon emissions, if we can get to not only net zero but negative carbon output, then we're going to be in a much better place. And if we can foster neuroplasticity in ways that, you know, that promote well-being in people, we're on a much better road as individuals and as a species. And so I guess it sounds corny, but it's like that Wilson Phillips song, hold on for one more day. Hold on for one more day. When you read my book, you'll understand those are not just words. Like I did experience some very difficult things. Lots of us have. And if I can do it, anyone can do it. I maybe that's dangerous to say, but I want people to be inspired to hold on and to have hope. And so the action would be to not accept the status quo in yourself and in your society, and to work for change. You know, working to, you know, if you are struggling with self-harm, that you take action to treat yourself with respect and nonviolence, and to seek help and to offer help to other people. And to, you know, to do things to call for systemic change. And I have heard of Travis Reeder, and I have not read his book, but it sounds really fascinating. And you know, it's you know, you're recycling. You know, you don't really know where your recycling is going. For example, you don't know where your recycling is going. And the fact of the matter is, a lot of it's going to the dump, but not all of it. And you don't know how much of it is, but you know what? You still maybe recycle. You try your best. You try and live with integrity, with ecological, ethical integrity, and encourage other people to do the same while knowing that that isn't going to, quote unquote, save us. What has to change is we need to kick our addiction, just like I kicked my addiction and other people have kicked their addiction. Our civilization has got to kick its addiction to fossil fuels. And that is out of the realm of one person's control. So that has got to be a collective action to change business as usual, and to really, not slowly, but quickly, dismantle the carbon combustion complex, because that's exactly what it is. That means rising up. That means voting. That means getting involved as best you can and not accepting the status quo. So I think that, you know, those are actions that I would take. And on my website, I have a variety of resources in terms of action, you know, a variety of resources that people can turn to if they want to help the, you know, the indigenous cultures of the Amazon who are getting the short end of the stick. Right, us in the West, in the developed world, we'll call it, are getting the benefits of some of these psychedelic medicines, but they are not getting the same benefit, economically, socioeconomically, And so, you know, going on my website, looking at these resources to help Indigenous people, to help Indigenous cultures, to help environmental groups that are working to save the Amazon and save places like Raja Ampat, this place that I traveled to many times in my book, Mothership, where some of the last intact coral reefs in the world are located. And so I write about that beauty. So you know, helping people, so working to save those special places. So all that is on my website. And so there's social action that can be accomplished. There is, and then there's also, you know, mental health steps, which I've pointed to that they can be taken as well. And so, you know, educating yourself about complex PTSD, educating yourself about developmental trauma, you know, whether you have that diagnosis or not, educating yourself about it, because you probably know someone who's struggling, who needs to read some of this research about the reopening of the critical periods for social reward learning. And they need to know that psychedelic assisted therapy, it's legal in a few places in the United States or in the world, but it's about to become more available. And so giving people that option, it's not compulsory, obviously. It's not something I would say you should do, but it's good to know that it's out there and it's a possibility, and you could get some relief. And there's a lot of evidence to back that up. So yeah, that's quite a smorgasbord of possibilities there. I hope that's useful to your listeners.
Yeah, not just theoretical. No, lots of concrete actions, which is yeah. Wonderful.
Yes, and my website is, if I could just say, my website is gregwrenn, gregwrenn.com. And if you go on my website, you can find those resources that I mentioned.
Well, Greg, that brings us to our traditional final question here on the New Books Network, which is, what are you working on next? More poetry, more memoir? What are you writing?
Oh, I'm writing emails, Claire.
Yeah.
Not for emails. I haven't really begun it, but I don't want to give too much away, but I do want to write a second book of prose. I have a book of poems that came out about 10 years ago, but I do have a second idea for a book. And I'll just say that it's going to be set almost entirely in the Amazon rainforest. And it might involve something called Umbandaime, which is a Brazilian syncretic religion that involves dancing while on ayahuasca. And so, and I talk about this a little bit in my book, in a couple scenes, and talk about the shaking off of trauma. Woo. So it's a really exciting avenue for me as a writer to explore, but I also am very interested in hearing from researchers who are wanting to combine to use movement, to use dance, paired with psychedelic assisted therapy. That seems like a very important avenue of research for scientists. But it is something that I want to look at in my next book. And talk more about ecological compassion and human destiny. It's one of my obsessions.
Well, great. Well, Greg, that all sounds wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing about Mothership, a memoir of wonder and crisis, and encourage our listeners to check it out.
Thank you so much, Claire. It's been such a pleasure to be here.